Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 16, and today I'm joined by John Leisiker, professor of philosophy at Emory University. John's research focuses on philosophical psychology, aesthetics, social and political philosophy, and 19th and 20th century continental and American philosophy. He has numerous publications in these areas, including two monographs. His first, You Must Change Your Life, Poetry and the Birth of Sense, was published in 2002 at Pennsylvania State University Press. And his second, Emerson and Self-Culture, was published in 2008 by Indiana University Press. It's the second book that brings him to the digital dialogue today. In it, John enters into dialogue with the thinking of Ralph Waldo Emerson in order to perform self-culture, which he understands as an ongoing activity of self-realization in which one articulates and affirms the commitments and values that animate one's life. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, John, to the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's great. Maybe we could talk first about, whether you agree with my little gloss of whether what self was that a right. good gloss of self-culture? I was playing with the words a little bit. Self-realization. I don't know if you've even buy into that idea of realization.
Yeah, I guess to start, I will buy into the language of self-realization if the being that's being realized changes, shifts,
right.
falls away, transforms.
Mm-hmm.
So people sometimes don't like the language of self-realization because it's sort of the acorn to the oak tree teleology,
right.
and we don't seem to unfold in patterns of growth at right, such right. that we could say it was the same telos the entire way through.
Right.
So as long as we put the shifting sands of the mortal condition
right.
into the project, then self-realization is fine. I would say that for self-culture is one way to think about it is how does one take responsibility for one's life?
Mm-hmm.
And one way to think about it is, well, I try to make sure that at all the points at which my life can be said to be unfolding,
right.
it unfolds in a way which testifies to, announces, serves as an apologia for
mm-hmm.
those values, commitments I would like to see furthered in the world.
Right.
And this means at all points. So how do I organize my domestic sphere?
Right.
How do I relate to my wife, Hillary? What the role of our dog Nessa in it? How do I relate to my neighbors?
Right.
What foodstuffs do I bring in? What foodstuffs don't? What poisons do I use?
Right.
How do I receive visitors? How do I deal with people who come to my porch who I don't want on my porch?
Right.
Right. So every sphere of action is a site in which our right ethos, our
sure.
moral character is continually announcing itself.
Right.
And the attempt of self-culture is to have a character announce itself in a way that we would say, yeah, I do it the same way again.
Right.
The trick, of course, is that we have learned about who we are and what our commitments are
right.
in the way in which we manifest ourselves to ourselves. So it's not, there's no template.
Right.
There's not, things are finally centered. The life of John is now, well organized and it's autopilot. But
right.
So that's...
So, and I mean, you directly... explicitly appeal to the German vocabulary of Bildung at the beginning.
Right.
And so that idea of culture as a project, as an educational project, a process of education.
Right. And a task.
A task, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And Emerson uses that language.
Right.
And he fusses. He's not sure. He realizes that when English folks say culture, what we mean is the background conditions, what anthropologists talk about.
Right.
But the idea that culture is a kind of task
right.
of building up a life that's praiseworthy. Right. The one thing that's powerful in Emerson is that culture is not just... There's the other side in English, particularly American English, or I'm going to get me some culture.
Right.
Right? I'm going to be cultured. Let's
right.
go do culture. And that sets up this highbrow set
yeah.
of activities.
It's in the museum.
Yeah, in the
yeah.
museum,
right.
the theater,
it's
concert
like getting
hall.
Some church.
Yeah, well, basically, there's a division of labor,
right.
and it's as if that's where we work on ourselves.
Right.
But Emerson, viewing all points of life
right.
as moments where the truth of our condition is made manifest to ourselves and sometimes to others who have a better beat on the truth of our character. So I love trying to take a term like Bildung to show that self-culture is a task and one that we can fail at. And that's what bringing the German in suggests. Simultaneously taking what risks sounding like a highbrow activity, which could be demarcated from something like business, you know, or who cleans the toilet at home, and just to say, no, it's the full range of life.
Right. So it's not it's something we're born into that we're undertaking and undergoing in some ways, because I do want to get into a kind of discussion about the role of history, the role of the historicity that you talk, and actually maybe a way of getting into that is to have you talk a little bit about the shifting sands of the self and your embracing of the concept of self, even as you, I think, or clearly in the book, want to undermine modern conceptions of subjectivity and certain kinds of strategies that move into a kind of more static, perhaps, conception of subject, or even a kind of subjectivity. I mean, the issue of your critique of autonomy, and there's sort of a strand that runs through the book that is a polemic kind of attitude toward a certain modern or liberal conception of autonomy.
Perhaps. Yeah, the great question, and it thrills me to see you pick up that thematic thread.
Okay.
Because there is that ongoing set of arguments, which on the one hand says the liberal Adam who enters into social relations, best described as contracts, is a goofy story. The claim that we are mere functions of larger wholes, whether social or natural, is an equally goofy story. So I am in this weird situation where I want to continue to use the language of self.
Right.
And I would have said individualism, except for the term being so overwrought.
You said it and then you backed way off.
Like I can't, you can qualify it as much as you want. No one will hear the qualifications.
Right. Yeah.
So let me say...
But I'm glad you would take that, because I try to articulate a distinction between what I might call, what I would call singularity, which is irreducible unicity, which is inevitably unknowable, and particularity, which is captured by concepts and universals, and the individual, which is precisely situated there between the two. So I would buy into your use of vocabulary of the individual, but I definitely appreciate your reasons for rejecting it.
Yeah, it just, at a certain point, you invest in language that you hope will bring about what, you know, what one's trying to bring about, if the writing is itself a kind of work.
Right.
And if you know, that the overweight of history on certain words.
Yeah.
It's so great that they won't say anything but what you want
them
to say.
But I mean, so then defend self.
Okay, so here, this is this language I try to use in the book of the personal.
Right.
So I'm trying to find what is the way in which I can say I am singular, irreplaceable, irreducible, and yet not a social atom. I'm not a substance. That part of me that is irreducible is not something that simply exists through itself.
Right.
I mean, that's the way people, you know. Yeah.
But I mean, so one issue is the atomistic. Well, there's two dimensions, it seems to be, about that.
Right.
One is it's too static. So it's rooted in this kind of ongoing understanding of, let's say, the subject as the hypocaemon on the underlying thing. The other is that it's isolated.
That's correct. That's good. And I would say the static for me is they come together in the idea of self-possessed.
Okay.
Because one can imagine it being a kind of activity, but it just exists through itself. And there's no way to talk about the human.
But self-possessed is good, right? If you're or is it bad?
It depends where, because there's a way in which self-culture is seeking a kind of self-control and self-possession.
Right, right.
But a lot's going to hinge on how we define the self there.
Sure.
So let me just take a step back and say, why maintain language of self at all? Because on the flip side, I'm not happy with what Foucault calls the total dispersion of the human, the language he uses in The Order of Things. And that's for the following reason. There are certain activities that my being is involved in that no one can do for me.
Right.
Not there's no, not saying there's a Kantian noumenal dimension to me that no one can access. And that's why I don't use the language of the private.
Right.
Right. It has to do with the nature of my being as activity.
Mm-hmm.
So we're eventually going to have to come around to Aristotle and Ergea.
Yes. Well, I'm happy to
right.
go there.
I know. And, and so what is it that really individuates me?
Right.
Or evidences my singularity? And for me, what evidences my singularity are those tasks that no one can do for me.
Right.
That does suggest that there's something singular to me, even if I'm a being of relation.
Yeah.
That still, what I in part bring to those relation are a set of activities no one can do for me. So, for example, right, no one can understand for another.
Right.
You can help me understand something.
Right.
You could hinder my understanding. But no matter how well you understand it, that will never accomplish understanding for me.
Right.
Perseverance. Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've had friends, if you know people who really suffer from a certain kind of depression.
Right.
Or self-doubt.
Right.
You can
well,
say anything.
Self-trust is a vocabulary that you also develop, right? This idea of self-trust, that would be, would that be something that I can't obviously do for you?
Correct. Yes, self-trust. That an insight I have is worth speaking
right.
out in a public situation. I trust it.
Mm-hmm.
No one can have self-trust for me.
So there's an owner, a dimension of ownership. By, well, of course, every word comes with a problem. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, ownership, not in the sense, ownership in the sense in which I think you began with, which was, responsibility, a certain taking over of responsibility for oneself. So it's not just about being thrown into a world where you have this, where you are a self, whether you want to be or not. I suppose there could be a process by which you would try to alienate yourself from yourself.
You could flee from that task.
Flee.
So one way of saying it
right.
is, you know, Kant loves to say, look, all my intuitions are indexed as mine.
Right. Right, right.
And I want to say, right, my existence is indexed as mine.
Mm-hmm.
But what mine means there is not occurring in the theater of my mind.
Right.
Mine means a task that no one else can carry out for me.
And fully embodied, historically situated. I mean, all of that comes
changing,
with
transforming.
Right.
But so the most fundamental way in which my being is mine is not something that I possess, but it's a task that requires my
ongoing.
Emerson talks about conspiring.
Conspiring.
So I say we have to conspire with our own condition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that facet of human existence that no one can live our lives for us,
right.
which individuates us and makes us singular,
mm-hmm.
and shows that we are irreducible to larger social networks.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes us who we are is ultimately not the hupocamenon. It's not
right.
a substance. There's
right.
no substratum there.
Right.
And it's nothing particularly private, because everyone around me can know better than I am that I'm fleeing the task of my life. Right? And, you know, in fact, they might make fun of me all the
right.
time. That's right. No, it's not the drinking. You're a
right.
coward existentially. So why maintain the language of self?
Right.
Is that there is a task
yeah.
that individuates me and that is irreducibly mine,
yeah.
and that I have to do certain things in order to keep the project of the life going.
Right.
Now, it's completely porous. I can be enabled and disenabled
right.
by all kinds of other persons,
right.
geological, atmospheric conditions, cultural scenarios, what have you. So there's no liberal atom there.
Right, right.
It's completely dependent on enabling and disenabling facts, moral luck,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But it nevertheless is irreducibly singular.
Right.
And for me, one of the principal metaphysical arguments of the book is that I've tried to articulate a language of personhood that eludes that worn-out dichotomy between the self-possessed liberal atom
right.
or we evaporate into networks of power,
right.
which has become the social constructivist discourse, which is a discourse which ultimately doesn't get vindicated because it always needs the demiurgos,
right,
from the Timaeus. Who's doing the work?
Right.
Who's slapping Houlet
right.
and Morphe together,
right.
producing Chris and John?
Right.
So one of the, I buried it. It's in a book about Emerson, but I think that's one attempt to make a contribution to what is a kind of exhausted discourse. And
right.
I think Emerson just also happens to be someone who can put it particularly
well. Let me ask you then about Emerson. I have take a drink, because I know you got to get a drink of water here. Let me ask you, there are a couple things, a couple directions maybe we could go. One is, I definitely want to go, we have over here Aristotle, I want to definitely talk about that. The other issue is, I would like to hear a little bit about how this might or might not relate to the Socratic idea of self-knowledge and the Greek idea of gnosis auton, know thyself, and the way in which that injunction really forces us into a recognition of our own finitude with all the complexities that come with that. But let's just hold those open for a second and have and talk a little bit about Emerson, because I mean, you know, there's a caricature of Emerson as a kind of individualist, you know, this rugged individualist, and it seems that you really are engaged in a dialogue with Emerson, at least that's how I'm reading this text, and one where you are not forcing him into certain kind of characters or categories, which I think Emerson himself would be glad to hear, obviously.
Right.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about why Emerson, right, it's not just happenstance that this is buried in a book about Emerson, right?
Right, I mean, no. I do think there are a number of reasons. One is, yes, Emerson has been subjected to a series of terribly flat-footed readings. I want to think human life as a project.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to think it where the author of that project is not the will, but at best we're co-conspirators in the unfolding of our life. Right. Can't really say much more than that.
So just one more about co-conspirators. Both because we are engaged with others in the process and because there's a natural necessity about human life, we have to drink water or, you know, eat food, breathe air, and it has to be of a certain kind. So there's this necessity. So in that sense, co-conspirating in the sense of both the way in which we conspire with nature and perhaps against nature, as well as with others in society.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And, right, as well as with, since both of those are not just external, but
right.
internal, because
right.
it's the language of my first person speech.
Right.
Or it's the, right, degree to which, right, what are the conditions under which I perspire or don't perspire? What's my diet? There's,
right,
this embarrassing image I've come up with, that one way to think about the way in which an Emersonian project unfolds through conspiring with our fatedness,
yeah,
or with the conditions that give us back to ourselves, is like an activity that I've never done, which is surfing.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because if you think about surfing, can take an unbelievable number of forces which convene and transform it into energy that propels us.
Right.
So normally we use the image of so-and-so is at sea.
Right.
And Emerson occasionally will be like, we're at sea and the best we share is I-beam. So
right.
being at sea is never a good image. And yet
we
know
are.
From surfing that there's a way of being at sea,
yeah.
which allows us to shoot the gulf,
right.
which is also Emerson's image of power.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the...
So that's
in the task of my life, I have to conspire with mm-hmm. my fatedness to bring about those conditions, self-culture, that I want to continue to affirm, that mm-hmm. I think produce a life worthy of praise and ongoing affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Emerson, when I look deeply into the way Emerson thinks about self-culture,
right.
I found that perspective without liberal self-possession,
mm-hmm.
the make it so
right.
self.
Right.
And in fact, in two ways. One, we've talked about already, and his term is quotation, or at least that's the way I use it.
Right.
He says, great line, I'm always paraphrasing, there's quotation down to the archangels if we could read that far.
Right.
Everything is always a repetition of a past inheritance. And he means that socially as well as physiologically. So on the one hand, right, a human being could become a sublime image of the whole network of relations, because they all convene there.
Right.
So, quick example, if we took a tree and we wanted to know what are all the forces that have to convene over the history of this tree and its development,
mm-hmm.
the universe would come rushing into that particular moment.
Right.
Right? We'd have a microcosm-macrocosm thing. We'd have to have soil history, things that have died and fallen. We'd have to use the sun. All of a sudden, we're pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. With mm-hmm. the rain, we're going to have to deal with the sea. We all know that where the rain falls is not where the water first came up.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we don't need Marx's social history to talk about the ways in which social life. So Emerson puts us always at a moment where unbelievable number of forces are convening and making possible our life. So that's when I read that, I thought, wow, that gives us the relational self.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in a way which doesn't suffer a nature-culture divide.
Oh, definitely. I mean, and one of the things that's exciting about what you're saying is because of the work that I've been doing or have just been doing with regard to Aristotle as read through people like Randall and Woodbridge and that American naturalist tradition, as well as with Heidegger, is that first of all, there's a lot to be gained by breaking down the boundary between the human and the natural, first of all. And second of all, though, and related to the points that you were making about quotation and, as you put it in the book, about eloquence, the way in which things are at work expressing themselves, and we have the capacity to respond in certain ways to those expressions, and everything hinges on our ability to respond in ways that are productive of what you're calling self-culture, and to use your vocabulary.
Right, and so this connects up with the self-knowledge.
Right.
So how is self-knowledge accomplished? Well, we're able to read our fadedness in its becoming and simultaneously see the moments of possibility, where we could go, right? Where might there be growth? Where might there not? Am I starting to find myself to be pigheaded and belligerent? And I have to pull back, or this looked like a promising future, but I realize I'm just repeating myself in these classes I'm teaching, and so I have to teach something else. So we're continually having to read our own actions and the situations in which those actions take place for a sense of what is the life that's reflected back, and is this a life I could continue to affirm or live?
So, but I mean, the reading, as I think you perform in the book itself really beautifully, is not just an activity on my part. So the way in which we read our lives is also partly determined by how our lives are read by others, by the history that sort of determined that life prior to it, and the way in which, you know, now to use the Heideggerian vocabulary, which I think you do address at some point in the book about the dimension of thrownness. And so there's a way in which I really like the way that you've entered into dialogue with Emerson as a living interlocutor.
Right.
And one who is speaking to you. And I mean, you have a couple of really interesting points about, you know, we wouldn't even call it a kind of hermeneutic stance, although you
sure, no, clearly that's what it is.
Right. So, what is the nature of that reading? The writing of this book, and for me, the reading of it is a reading of a text at a moment by a person who I know in a historical context, and it has a resonance for me for certain kinds of reasons.
Right. Two things. One then is, not only is the task of self-culture faded by enabling and disenabling conditions. It's quoting a sort of history. That could start to sound as if the multiple books of nature are speaking to us, and then we try to read them.
Right.
But do we ask questions? Does something like dialogue become part of that practice? And for Emerson, the term is conversation.
Okay. And that has the dimension of converting, too, of turning.
Absolutely. Yeah, so conversation is going to be part of the practice in which, we co-conspire.
Right.
In a way where we were, the process of our own becoming becomes, intertwined.
Right.
And that's why there's a whole chapter devoted to friendship,
right?
What are some of the practices in which, we read each other together, buoy each other, challenge each other, push each other.
Right.
How is it that these projects could overlap and be pursued in common, and not in a, literally in a way where our very being, and our very project became inseparable.
Right.
And this is the power of thinking about friendship.
Right.
And what makes the notion of Aristotelian friendship a virtue so untimely in our period, because we're so dominated by altruism and
egoism.
And egoism.
Right.
And what happens, though, when your well-being is my well-being.
Right.
And I attend to it, Am I being altruistic or egoistic? Right. Well, it just blows up the distinction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that goes to the heart, and actually, in some ways, that's why the image of, or the figure of Socrates is also so powerful. I mean, that Greek conception of personhood is not caught up in the whole movement of modern subjectivity, so that you can have a conception of friendship like you're articulating,
right,
which just explodes the division between altruism and egoism precisely because we are both oriented toward being good or being the best, being excellent, put it
right
in those terms, right?
Yeah.
And so that orientation to being excellent, it's going to mean that something different to you because of your singularity, maybe we could say, and then it does to me, but I can see that in you, and I can see it in me, and I do think that there is a way in which they will resonate because they're oriented.
Well, and I would go even further
yeah
on that. And
okay.
See, at least I think I'm going further. And that is your orientation towards your good,
mm-hmm,
and your ability to realize that good is part of my good.
Right.
So, literally.
Right.
I've been teaching Aristotle. That's probably why it keeps creeping in.
That's
I'm
great
doing this freshman seminar on the good life. I'm doing the Joe Sachs translation,
right,
and being at work.
Excellent.
So my understanding is that in friendship of virtue, unlike friendship of use and pleasure,
right,
it isn't just incidental. It's not just a small point of our being at work
no
overlaps and then we share it.
Right.
But it's that our pursuit of happiness, the whole orientation of our being, is so intertwined that your pursuit of the good is part of my pursuit as well.
Right.
And vice versa.
Right.
And, you know, and this, I mean, for me, then that really suggests that there's a joint project.
Right. Right.
It doesn't mean that it necessarily has to, right, require the self-same.
Right.
Determinate understanding of all aspects of what counts as human flourishing.
Right.
Sort of the way Cicero seems to require it.
Right.
But it does mean that I cannot claim to be accomplishing self-culture,
right,
right, in a way that I think is praiseworthy and worthy of my continual pursuit of it, if I allow your self-culture to founder.
Right.
And that there's a moment there of moral growth that I want to say Emersonian self-culture is capable of,
mm-hmm,
because the worry is going to be, self-culture sounds like just bourgeois activity. I'm glad
right
you made it lowbrow.
Right.
Well, sweet, now you have a well-decked-out home and you shop at Whole Foods.
Right.
But it's still mostly a bourgeois activity.
Uh-huh.
And I want to say, well, no, let's look now. First of all, it can involve friends.
Right.
And in fact, it would have to.
It has to. I was going to say it has to.
Yeah, it would have to. I mean, who wouldn't, right? No one would choose to live without friends.
But I mean, in this sense, this is why, from my perspective, in trying to think of through the transformative possibilities of dialogue, I mean, this is in some ways exactly what this project is articulating. Namely, all of this is happening in relation to others. So you talk about the self as being relational to its core. I don't even want to use the word core, but relational.
No, sure.
And
yeah.
And that it is...
We have moving cores.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Like a certain kind of composition has a shifting tonal center.
Right.
But at a various moment, a life will have a core. That's how it acquires a rhythm and a purpose. And,
right.
But I agree.
Exactly.
You don't have
no
to substantiate.
Right. I just, I hear myself going into a substantivist kind of way, and I always try to hold myself back because I'm committed to the same
yeah,
point
yeah, right
that you're trying to make. So let me ask you this about the...
Can I pick up? Because
yeah,
you
go
said,
ahead,
and
go
I've failed to pick up on what you've said twice now, and,
okay,
and that is... But you're absolutely right.
A good dialogue.
The book is
back
performing a sort of ongoing conversation with Emerson because that's inseparable from the work of genuine self-culture. And it's weird. I get these reviews of the book, mostly positive.
Yeah.
But then they say things like, but it's mostly intellectual history.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, no. Or they say, it's too much me.
Right.
Or it's too much Emerson.
Yeah.
But the idea that the project is carried out in this dialogue
yeah
with Emerson, ongoing conversation,
right,
which is agonistic at moments.
Yeah, it definitely
right
is. That.
And so there's a way in which what doesn't show up till chapter 6 or something, I can't remember, but that's
right
a friendship chapter,
yeah,
is supposedly performatively being
right
carried out the whole time.
But
because conversation and dialogue are at this point, I couldn't imagine continuing to live a life,
right,
that I would continue to praise, including, write books, be a philosophy professor, that didn't have that kind of careful reading, responsiveness, imaginative variation, taking Emerson as my contemporary, sometimes as my teacher, sometimes as someone I think needs to be set aside on
questions
of race.
My understanding of Emerson is he would embrace all of that. I mean, the negative side of the life of quotation is that you take over that past as if it had an authority that it doesn't have, or that it has to some degree, but that you let that eclipse your own capacity to respond. So, I mean, I wonder if I wanted to make a comment about the performative aspect of the book, because I don't think, let me put it autobiographically for a second. I think in like this project with the digital dialogue, with trying to perform some scholarship, teaching and research in public using digital media, there's a performative commitment I have that I know is not in certain circles respected intellectually, academically, but there's a rigor to it that I really respect in your book, and the rigor of the performative is not appreciated often in a certain kind of academic setting.
Yeah.
Is that fair, you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do think philosophers in general are not good readers of performativity. We read for thematics. We want to know what the claims are.
Right.
And picking up on the performativity of an address, many philosophers aren't particularly good at it.
Right.
Richly picking up on the performativity of an address, where its rigor is manifested. So its mood, its pacing, the way in which a disagreement is managed.
Yeah.
So for me, part of the performativity is I try to establish the conditions under which I cannot no longer inherit an aspect of Emerson's thought.
Right.
So I can't repeat it.
Right.
So I say it and I articulate it in order to let it go.
Right.
And I'm establishing the terms under which I say, our being at work, when it overlaps here, I can't carry this on.
Right.
And here's why.
Right.
Now, that's not just a confession. That's also a way, a provocation, which says, you should drop this stuff.
Right.
So the heavy devotion to theological motifs and tropes in Emerson, I want to say, I want a post-theological self-culture.
Okay.
So I agree with you that the rigor of performativity, I think a large number of people are deaf to it. I think those who sort of get it as, of course there is performativity, aren't good trackers of how it zigs and zags.
Right.
In very complicated ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to say that, so again, for some people, a set of autobiographical interjections is quaint and interesting ornamentation.
Right.
For others, it's a distraction.
Right.
It doesn't sustain interest. They'd rather hear about facts about Emerson's life because he's a famous person.
Right.
And my claim is, and thematically, not optional.
Right.
You cannot read Emerson if you do not allow Emerson to read you.
Right.
And if we're not involved, if we don't feel called to the carpet by his affirmations, by his denunciations, by his provocations, we are not reading him.
Right.
So I want to claim, like even as if we were new critics, we are not reading Emerson.
Right.
If we just try to master his texts, or we do source criticism.
Now, would you expand? I mean, because I could see, so my mind goes immediately to Plato, because I think Plato was a writer who refuses to allow you to ignore the performative dimension of his thinking.
Despite best.
Yeah, despite the fact that there's a whole tradition of Platonism
you can't
to do it. But there are ways in which he writes. All of his writing is so self-consciously attentive to the performative, the dialogical in the dramatic, that you and there are ways in which, by framing and other kinds of things, that he forces you, a reader who is attentive, responsible is what I would call it, able to respond, both able to respond, but also able to hold accountable. right? As you're saying, what you're doing with Emerson.
Yeah.
And I think I mean I try to do it too, also with Aristotle. And I do think that there would be a way of reading the entire history of philosophy in this responsive, dialogical way that attends to the performative dimensions. That would require us to rethink a lot of the stories we tell about the history of metaphysics, you know, the metaphysics of presence, that, you know, that would, I mean, just take somebody like Descartes, who everybody wants to beat up on, and I've been known to do that myself. The Meditations is about as performative as it gets.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that there's something, you know, there's a long history of this and something that's really philosophically
right.
important, partly because I think it forces the philosophy to be embodied. You in reading and responding to this text, you have to live it to some degree as
right.
you respond, as
yeah.
you write about it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's no, I sort of buy the claim coming out of speech act theory, there's no language without a performative dimension. It's always an address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why
and,
are you
and,
picking
and there's
the
a character of an address.
Right.
And so, for instance, like, riffing on what you said about Descartes, when
yeah.
I teach Kant, I usually start with what is enlightenment,
right.
and where he holds up the public use of reason.
Right.
And I said, so the critique of pure reason is the public use of reason.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a performative address there.
Right, right,
right.
Right.
And there's a way in which, that's one way in which, not just that it continually tries to expose dogmatism, I mean, that's part of Howard's critique.
Right.
But it's also, right, part of the public use of reason.
Exactly.
Secured by a large army. What does he say? Right, one of the
right.
keys is at the end, you need public use of reason, and we ought to be able to criticize, and we need an army.
And then we need an army.
Yeah, just in case. But so I think, I agree, rereading all these texts, being able to apprehend and attend to their various kinds of performativity
right.
Would open up a very interesting
yeah.
Way of rethinking the history of philosophy. Yeah. Another course I taught, Hobbes.
Uh-huh.
And Hobbes is really trying to establish a commonwealth
uh-huh.
that doesn't need recourse to any sacred norms.
Uh-huh.
So he's carrying out what Durkheim says. I mean, the norms which hold together the social order have been right, no longer have sacred grounding.
Right.
And Hobbes is saying that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
But that means our language
right.
has to be able to carry the day.
Right.
The language we have in common
mm-hmm.
has to be capable of bringing about a normatively binding social compact. So why does Leviathan begin with all of these concerns about the nature of language and his worries about metaphors? He's performatively addressing
mm-hmm.
his public,
mm-hmm.
saying, we need to get our language under control.
Right.
I mean, you're seeing the moral practice of
right.
of Hobbesian thought there
right.
being carried out. Just like in Plato, we're seeing,
yeah.
you know, well, this line of argument's going to fall down, and we're going to have to decide. Maybe they should have gone left here. There was a moment there that was lost.
Right.
And usually when it's lost, someone wants to flee, and they need to be encouraged. Right.
Courage, yeah.
So I think that I would like to see all readings of any philosophical text remain cognizant of the performativity of the address of the text they're reading and the performativity of their own response.
Well,
and that ought to draw the canopy over whatever follows. And that requires that the past be present. So
right.
there's a weird way in which those readings are always in the now.
Right, right.
Right? It's not the ahistorical now. But there's a way in which, at that moment, I want to claim there's a performativity of Emerson's address which is knocking on my window saying, yo, John, check this out.
Right.
And there's a way in which he, as long as that address can be heard, and I attend to it as an address which
right.
is saying to me, do you have sufficient self-trust?
Yeah.
Are you conforming? Right.
Right.
Then,
well, right.
right, that, if we elevate the performative dimension, not just that we'll have different readings.
Right.
That the moral practice of our readings and discussions with one another, I think, will shift.
Right.
And I think there's a way in which we'll reanimate the humanities
right.
to still be about living issues as opposed to, I'm the master of these texts.
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the things that I think the performative dimensions that we're talking about allow for, or in fact enable and maybe require, is that one is open to one's own transformation by this encounter. And so that actually brings me to this question, back to the question of Socrates, Socratic self-knowing, and in specifically, what are the kinds of, I'll use the language of virtue, or I'll use the language of excellences, that we have to cultivate in one another. And I consider this an aspect of education, and what right. at least I am undertaking as part of a someone who takes my teaching and takes my relationship with students and what I'm doing for my life seriously, is in some ways the cultivating of excellences that will allow people, students, and myself to be open to the those moments of transformation,
right.
and to read in ways that it, that are genuinely responsive. But what are the things we need to do to cultivate that? I mean, certainly
right.
a kind of openness. Well, you're talking a little bit about self-trust, and then you do talk about that in the discussion of the eloquent life, which I did want to ask you about also. But let's focus
right.
on the excellences question.
Yeah, so in the move from the second to the third chapter, the second
yeah.
tries to say the source of our best insights is nothing that is ours in the way that we possess it.
Right.
Emerson says, no, I'm more possessed by my genius, by my the genie, right?
Right.
And he's really in dialogue with Plato a lot on these scores. You know, the daemon.
Right.
It's incalculable. And then the problem is, well, that's starting to sound like bad romanticism. You got to give over to autopilot.
Right.
And he flirts a little bit with that. Like, the rose outside my door doesn't need
yeah.
to fuss. It's just a beautiful rose.
Right.
That image that Rilke gets all
yeah.
geeked about when he writes all these late French poems. And then that creates the problem. It sounds like if self-culture just gives way to unconscious nature, there's really no work to be done.
Right.
The only work to be done is to get is to have reflection get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem there is, of course, in simply trying to get out of the way, you're not getting out of the way, and you're just doomed. It's unhappy consciousness.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right.
Time to start drinking.
Right.
So the third chapter then says, but wait, maybe we have to play along in certain ways. We're back to that reading our possibilities,
right.
building up our potential, such that we might be able to realize a self that we think is worth realizing.
Right.
And so then it's the third chapter. I think we could say these are some of the excellences,
uh-huh.
meaning these are tasks. I would say these are the personal tasks that
right.
no one can do for us.
Right.
And then we would say the hope would be that in carrying them out, a kind of arete where it manifests. So what are those? For Emerson, self-trust is premium.
Right.
Because he thinks we're always better than we usually perform.
Right.
He I mean, this is partly his sense of America in the 1830s and 1840s.
Right.
Is that it has thoughts and insights that it's ashamed of because they're its own.
Right.
It's already contaminated by being from a Yahoo country. And so it won't act on them. It won't venture them.
Right.
It won't abandon itself to them. So a big premium is that the mortal fruits of right this anarchic right
mm-hmm.
meeting point that
mm-hmm.
my being is,
right.
which involves others in conversation and a long history of language and texts and cultural institutions and natural geographical settings and personal health and physiology. What is it true that out of that weird stew
mm-hmm.
an insight could emerge around which a future could be built?
Mm.
Only a being of self-trust can say, yes, I give myself over to that despite its crazy origin,
mm-hmm.
despite its human, all too human, right, beginnings points, and it's more than human.
Right.
Right. Because of how involved we are with the more than human world and history. I mean,
right.
There's no way even to delimit
right.
the site of our own beginning with a figure like the human. So he thinks we suffer a kind of self-trust.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, then, rather than saying, I will stake my life on this, what emerged from I know not whence, our being descends into us from we know not whence. Great line from a normally unreadable essay, The Oversoul.
Right.
So self-trust is one of those virtues.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to give myself over to that. the other options are, of course, conformity.
Right.
What we do is we conform to someone else. All right. Mm-hmm. Or it's just fear.
Right.
But there's another one then. And this is what comes out in circles. And he says, right, every sort of birth in our life. So if we take Heideggerian thoroughness as an ongoing event.
Right.
Quick aside, everyone who thinks Heidegger has no natality, shut up. Well, Geworfenheit is ongoing natality. Sorry, I don't know.
I'm
not going to tell people to shut up in dialogue. Right, but thoroughness as an ongoing event, we're continually being reborn to our condition.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, Arendt gets it right from there.
Yeah, and so I don't think Heidegger has a problem with natality.
Okay.
Be that as it may, right? So Emerson...
But he may prioritize death in a way that might be problematic. I mean, there is a way in which we might say that this prior and the own most and all that stuff, it seems to me that it could, although I don't know that it's fair, that it could go over to, you know, the tragic and all this stuff.
I'm fine with it.
We'll have another digital dialogue
with
Heidegger and on throne.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, good.
But so I have to trust.
Yeah.
Because that's all I have. Even if in the end I go with your point of view, I still have to deem it worthy.
Right.
So there's really no hiding from it. Right. So this sort of Sartrean idea, condemned to be free. I think Emerson, in the end, the future is going to unfold because I've given myself over to it in some way.
Right.
Maybe in a conforming way, maybe in a cowardly, bad faith sort of way. But that's going to be required in order for the human project to keep unfolding. What Emerson says, though, is once we do that, right, we open up a circle, and the life is carried out within that circle. And then he says, and we try to preserve it. He says, whatever was made possible there starts to hem us in and doesn't want to be overthrown.
Right.
So another virtue. So we have sort of self-trust.
Right.
Or he says aversion to conformity.
Mm-hmm.
But another virtue is we have to be able to throw ourselves over outmoded habits, limiting conditions, history.
Right.
And that needs to become a proactive struggle.
Yeah.
So he says, his language is we need to east ourselves.
Right.
And I love this line from Heidegger. He says that when we want to read Hölderlin, it's a struggle against ourselves.
Uh-huh.
Self-culture is ironically an ongoing struggle against our tendencies towards self-preservation.
Right.
So...
But I mean, how do you get... I mean, just in terms of... I mean, I completely agree that the two virtues that you've articulated are crucial. But how? I mean, they're incredibly difficult in a certain way. That tendency to preserve, that tendency to encounter those who want to preserve, maintain, who when exposed to something, and I'm thinking just in this context of the possibilities that are opened by a certain kind of digital social media.
On the one hand, the
response is no, you know, close down, lock down, shut it down, slow it down.
Right.
You know, whereas, like, to me, I'm thinking of, well, that wasn't Plato's response to the emergence of writing as a technology for art, for literacy. He said, yeah, there are problems, but he wrote.
Yeah, and he wrote about those problems.
Yes, and he performed it in writing. And he said, look, I'm not going to eschew this, like Socrates perhaps did, this new technology this new literacy. I'm going to say, I'm going to go in there with open eye. I'm going to conspire with it. But it's also conforming me. I mean, there's a way in which we can't be naive. You're saying this. We are being conformed by it. We're being disciplined, to use the Foucauldian language. We're being disciplined by it in certain ways. But it also opens up possibilities that would have been impossible.
That's right. And I would say, though, for Emerson, it's really about the whither.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say we're being conditioned,
mm-hmm.
but I'm only worried about that if it takes me somewhere I really don't want to go.
Right, right.
Because there will be no... So I don't think having to play with the spot where we've been thrown.
Right.
That's just part of being human.
Right.
That's the human condition.
Right.
And that's the only spot we have.
Right.
And so I wouldn't call... that conforming to those conditions, because the only meaningful expression of a human project is because we're not self-executing beings. We have to work with that.
Right.
So the only way in which I'm going to get across the water is I'm going to have to find a way to work with currents.
Mm-hmm.
That's human ingenuity and freedom and power.
Right.
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 Freedom is not, I will make it so there's no water.
Right. Right.
Right. And so I think that would be another kind of virtue then. How can I conspire with my fatedness?
Right.
But that's going to be very tricky, right? That really requires, there aren't going to be a ton of general rules to the particular occasion. And so,
in some ways, there are no rules. I mean, what you're articulating is not a rule-based understanding of ethos, right? This is an
this is why they're excellences,
exactly.
Right? And we try to acquire the active condition or the hexis, that,
right.
So we stand a better chance.
Right.
And Emerson's language, I love it, being equal to the occasion.
Exactly.
So this requires, though, also extreme concentration, right? There's an ability to concentrate. And this goes back to the rigor of the performative.
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah.
To make this realize a future that we would give ourselves to again.
Right.
That doesn't mean I would have done it in the same way.
Yeah.
But it means I'm willing to continue to conspire. So it's conceivable at a certain point, if Plato had said, I thought there was a future in writing, but it's the devil.
Right.
Right? Or we could say this about the digital. Right?
Right, yeah.
Is that, I think... Of course, the digital here is really the auditory.
Right, right.
It's not that different from radio.
Right.
The visual worries me a little.
Yeah.
Because we have a hard time processing.
Yeah.
As humans, there seem to be limits.
Right.
A rush of visual information.
Right.
And auditory information
right.
that's more than sloganeering.
Exactly.
So we just have to see.
But what's interesting,
the new
about
generation is incapable of it.
They're learning.
They claim they're good multitaskers.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, they're just not paying attention.
Well, that's true.
So do you see, so we would say, I conspired, but it didn't.
Right.
It didn't shoot, I didn't shoot the golf.
Right. Right.
You know, what happened was I keep having to swim back to
try
shore.
Right.
You know, so I have to decide balsa wood makes a bad surfboard.
Right. Well, I mean, the other thing that is part of this with regard to the digital is, I mean, there is a plurivocity of modes of articulation. There's the written in the form of blogs and other kinds of wikis and all these other things. There's the audio with podcasting. There's
right.
the audio and the visual with
sure.
video. And so what I'm recognizing and beginning to think more about is how each media is able to do certain kinds of things well, but other kinds of things it doesn't do so
exactly.
well. There are certain kinds of possibilities, but other kinds of dangers.
And that's no different than having a written style.
Right.
Style is about how one inhabits one's language.
Right.
To the point of Emerson's an eloquence that can agitate. Right. And this goes back to how do we how do we work on people as educators to get this? And he says in the Divinity School address, really what you give another person is provocation.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes that leads certain people to say, well, he has no commitments at all.
Right.
He's just poking at us. Trust yourself, trust yourself, trust yourself. It's like, thanks, one essay, maybe an index card, let's move along.
Right.
I mean, his provocations are much more nuanced and sophisticated in that some of the provocations are giving us futures that we thrill to.
Right.
So we get a kind of character and we think, wow, that's admirable.
Right.
So he's laying out a content thematically rich set of possibilities and we're like, I want to be that kind of person. He's not telling us, this is the good, go seek it.
Right.
He's winning over our affirmation and then asking us to take responsibility for
it. Right. But let me ask you about this good, because actually this is something that I've been thinking a lot about with regard to Socrates. Because Socrates does, in a certain sense, appeal to that to the good, precisely for this, I think, future that you can be excited about, in the sense that... we've been talking a lot about historicity, thrownness, and all of this stuff to this point. But we haven't talked quite as much about, only until this point, about the future dimension, or the orientation toward the future, toward the possible, toward that which we want to affirm. Right?
Yeah.
So, and there, I think you do bring in the question of the ideal or the eidos in the Socratean sense, that is not something that's possessible, but that stands there to pull us to pull us toward it in an erotic
way. So this is the image of the sun and dawn, and this is the image of youth. So he keeps talking about the young, keeps talking about sunrises,
right?
And this goes back to the self and becoming and the shifting sands. We don't know, right? We don't know how we'll be called in a new direction. What will seem to be a new set of possibilities. What we'll have to throw down. Whether we'll have to recreate ourselves.
Right.
It may mean that a form of life grows old, but sadly it grows old when we're only 40.
Right.
So then we have to conspire with this newly emerging media.
Right.
And we have to start trying to, I now have to try to figure out a performative rigor in a style where I can inhabit this media.
Right.
In order to bring about provocations.
Speak in your own voice.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is to say then that it's still purposive striving.
Right.
So functionally, by definition, in a transcendental logical sense, there is a good towards which we're being oriented.
Right.
Right. And we're giving ourselves over to it.
Right.
The way of abandonment. He'll say that life is the way of abandonment. And you get both the sense of a departure and a giving over to.
Right.
And then, you know, so then the question is to what?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this raises the question of the good. And one of the most famous lines in Self-Reliance, he imagines an interlocutor. Because you just sort of said, like, you know, I'm going with whim. I write whim on my door. And I hope it's not whim, but I can't spend the day in expiation.
Right.
There's a lot to say about that image and its dealing with certain Hebrew traditions and the like. But let's just, right, he's clearly saying, you know, if I spend the whole day trying to resolve the legitimation crisis, I will have actually sacrificed my opportunity.
Right.
So we need the way of abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we need to act. And I think that captures a lot of what Derrida tries to accomplish in Force of Law.
Uh-huh, right.
You can't fulfill justice by not acting.
Right, right.
Right. And so there's a madness of decision.
Yeah.
Well, when Emerson says that the way of life is the way of abandonment, and I can't spend the day in expiation,
right,
you know, that's sort of saying there's a break on justification, because otherwise I sacrifice any livable future.
Right.
Someone says, well, how do you know, though, that what inspires you doesn't come from below?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he says, it's one of the great throwdowns, where he just says, you know, if I am the devil's child, then I will live from the devil. And people are like, what could he possibly mean? And what I try to argue in the book is that not in any historical way that he's repeating Milton's Satan.
Right.
Better to rule in hell than kneel in heaven.
Uh-huh.
Right. But that... that there is a way in which he is satanic in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at what he says in the Divinity School address, he basically says, like, Jesus was onto something, but it's ongoing revelation, pal.
Right. Deal with that.
That's not the end of the game.
Right.
You know, I'm taking Quakerism seriously enough that there's ongoing revelation, and there's a weird way of resting with Jesus. And this is exactly what Satan is so angry about in Paradise Lost.
Right.
Is that Jesus is elevated above all the other angels. And Satan's pissed. And there's a way in which that spirit is all the way through Emerson. And so you get this sort of de-deification of the person of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean then? Is that a voluntarism? Are we reducing then the good to what it's good because I say it is? Mm-hmm. So this, it can't be a voluntarism.
Right.
This gets very complicated. All right. But, so, we're not going to get a universal definition of the good.
Right. As we don't in Plato.
No,
as
we're not even going to seek it.
Oh, okay.
Right? He's not going to pull one of these Euthyphros, here's what I want out of you.
Right.
Aristotle's going to say, forget about it, you know, we're not going to go with it. So, on the other hand, he loves involuntary perceptions.
Uh-huh.
So he's more of the poet in the sense of the ion than Plato's comfortable with.
But I mean,
because the rhapsode, there's a way in which the given is, I mean, the good is given in a moment of rhapsody, and we try to give ourselves to it. So I'll just finish this line of thought.
Yeah.
So part of then the argument in the fifth chapter, which is called the ethos of the moment, is to say that there are moments when we are so claimed by something as the future that must be pursued that we have, in a sense, an obligation to give ourselves to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way in which that will exceed any categorical justification.
Right.
And I push Emerson, so this is another answer to why Emerson, because I do think under the weight of Levinas and Derrida and Adorno, for good reason, people can only understand that as incipient totalitarianism.
Right.
And we do not have discourses of affirmation. Right.
Right.
We have discourses of infinite negation.
Right.
And I know some people say, no, you misunderstood, but I haven't had the time to develop it here between us. But I think I can cash this out, that there's a way in which the relentless negativity of a variety of positions has exhausted itself, and we need a way to think about abandonment without shame or spending the day in expiation.
Right.
And so one of the moments is that when we're claimed, and we're just saying, look, this is the future I have to go with, and it right. will die without me pursuing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I write my name on that. That's the name on my door.
Mm-hmm.
So when people come and they say, what kind of person lives here?
Mm-hmm.
Right? They don't see the little quotes from Deuteronomy. They see, this is what I'm staking my life on.
Yeah.
Right? Now, but on the other hand, right, that is contravened in part by cultivating, right, the attempt to east oneself,
yeah.
to not grow stale.
Right.
So right, we,
right.
so there's this, there is this sort of ethos of self-interruption.
But doesn't it in some way, I mean, could it be thought to emerge out of that very process of self-culture? That is to say, that we engage with others, so that in our discussion, in this very conversation, in reading, in engaging with your book, that something of the insistence of what I'm going to stake my life on begins to emerge for me.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a way in which, if it occurs in a context of friendship,
right,
we owe it to each other to remain true to that as long as it remains living, as long as it still opens futures that we can in good faith give ourselves to. But we're also worried about that,
yeah.
right? So when it wanes and nothing takes its place, we don't fill that gap with bravado.
Right.
And then all of a sudden Emerson starts to look a little bit more like Montaigne,
mm-hmm.
which is nothing is claiming me. Nothing is opening. There's no new dawn. I don't feel young again.
Right.
So I'm not going to pretend. And I'm also going to conspire against some of my best moments and worry about it
mm-hmm.
rhetorically. I'm going to go talk to people and I'm going
right.
to say,
right.
this just seems like, is it too good to be true? Let's work on it. Let's
right.
see.
Right.
So we're trying not to maintain a fanatical relation. One other thought, though, because that starts to sound like it's an antinomy.
Right.
So I'm radically affirming and I'm radically interrupting. Thanks for nothing. What ends up happening, though, is that the radical interrogations, pursuits of destabilization, attempts to sort of say, this maybe is not my beautiful house. This is
right.
not the world I want to continue to build. That also, though, opens us up, I mean,
right.
to the possibility of being claimed by another dawn or youth.
Right.
Right. right. But there's a way in which Emerson says, I will not be ashamed for having given my life over to the utter, fragile, beautiful future that a mortal life is capable of beginning to see and pursue. And there's just a refusal to apologize for that, to be ashamed. And I think that's the most non-theologically powerful moment, because that says, I will give myself to this future without needing the mediation of a theological figure. So, you know, I do think that the good is there structurally because it's purposive action. The good is there thematically because we need a determined future in order to pursue it.
Mm-hmm.
And really the only way you get a new future is when a determinate one shows up.
Right.
It's like, how do you get over having lost a love? Some you fall in love again.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise you're kind of just, you know, occasionally nostalgic, treading water. The only way to really get over it mm-hmm. is to actually have some new love.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so the good can't just be this sort of formal thing we keep.
Right.
It has to literally be able to orient a future. It has to have enough force
right.
that it brings shape to our practices. It excludes certain things. It leads us to select means.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It really has to play an ordering function, give us a temporary core,
right.
to go back to that language.
Right.
And, you know, but the scene in which that good could be found, the site where ideals are made, to go to Nietzsche's language
right.
in Genealogy of Morals. I can't remember how he describes it, but they're like bellows and
right.
furnaces. And you know, Emerson just, I think, all but for the theological things which sell it out at a certain point,
right.
really allows the utter anarchic mortality of that to carry the day. And,
right.
and there he seems to be not... seems to me more radical and not quite as... He's beginning to live in the death of God that
right.
Gets articulated after him.
Right.
in Nietzsche. Although he does say in the Divinity School, we live as if God were dead. That's a line there. And there he seems to me potentially more radical than what I get out of Aristotle right. and Plato.
Right.
But, you know, that all depends.
Right.
I mean, those are hard questions to ultimately answer without laying down texts. And given that all texts are self-deconstructing, do you see what... I mean, right. there's no way sure. you could really resolve it.
Exactly.
So when we see a self-deconstructing moment in Plato or in Aristotle, right. is that a rhetorical move?
Right.
Or is
right.
that just that all would be... Right.
Right.
You know, self-writing languages that they end up undermining themselves. I don't...
Yeah.
You know, at a certain point, I don't think we can answer
right.
answer that. But I do see that kind of sense of the sheer mortality of a good that could organize a life, that he's capable of an affirmation without bad metaphysics, without undue epistemic certainty,
right.
and without gleeful romantic abandon.
Right.
That he really articulates the kind of shape of a moral character there that I don't see. I just, you know, that seems to me why Emerson for this and why yeah. he's the interlocutor for my project, because he helps me articulate that,
yeah.
that kind of
character. Well, and you've articulated it beautifully, and I really appreciate you coming on to the Digital Dialogue and sharing it with me and giving us an opportunity to perform some self-culture in our discussion, I hope.
I'm completely thrilled that you had me on, and hopefully we'll keep talking about this.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U on the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. This has been The Digital Dialogue.